Thank you so
Good
much,
afternoon.
Molly.
Afternoon.
Well, thank you so much. I'm going to kick us off. This is Emily. We've presented the sublicensing income seminar, I suppose, at the annual meeting several times now, and it's we've been asked to do this again. So Jim and Ashley have presented with me. I think it's this is our third time together. And just for a fun background, I was counsel for University of California on the Medivation cases we'll talk about later today. And Ashley was actually the expert on the other side, so we always have fun presenting together at this because we don't always agree on everything. But thank you so much for joining us today. We're just going to go ahead and get started. So the things that we're going to talk about today are four things: the importance of sublicensing income, the purpose of sublicense income, the incentive problem, which comes from how your language is in your contract and how that creates perverse incentives for some of your licensees, and the key issues that you'd like to watch out for as you proceed with your licensing agreements with your licensees to account for sublicensing income. So the importance of sublicense income. So why do we care? So universities, as you know, receive a lot of revenue under the license agreements, and the 2016 Adam survey reported total licensing income as close to $3 billion. But the share of licenses generating more than $1 million remain less than 1%, and that share has been decreasing. And sublicensing income can be very significant when you have that one blockbuster, because you license to a licensee, and that licensee, if it's a really really blockbuster technology, is going to be able to generate a lot of income through sublicensing. And so, and particularly in the biotech space, we're finding that a lot of universities have licenses with small companies, and this makes a lot of sense. 70%, the Autumn survey says that small startup companies were 70% of executed license. These licenses have really modest upfront fees and royalties. You're really taking a chance on these companies and getting your technology out there. And sublicensing income can be a real great way to share in the success of that company should you get a blockbuster. Another way that this happens is equity. Of course, we're not going to talk about equity today, but those are kind of the ways that we share in the upside of your licensee's success. And then by doing that and by backloading it, you're able to offer these modest upfront fees and royalties to stimulate the economy, to get the small tech companies up and running. I mean, this is a common strategy that we see with universities. So what does the licensee do? So the consideration to the sublicensor can take many forms, meaning what your licensee gets from its sublicensee is very similar to what you get from your licensee. You get upfront fees, milestones, cost reimbursement, royalties on sales, profit sharing, investment, equity. It's all sorts of creative ways to get income from sublicensees. And that amount of money that a licensee is getting, your licensee is getting from the sublicensee, can be far, far, far in excess of what you as the university get from your licensee. So we've seen upfront payments over $100 million. Royalties on sales can be multiples greater than the royalties in the original license. Overall compensation might be 10 times greater than that due to the university under provisions other than the sublicensing income. So this is a fairly significant source of revenue, and that we need to think about how you capture a portion of that revenue in your license that you make up front with your original licensee. And what is the purpose of sublicensing income? It allows universities to share in the value that their inventions create, and it enables discussed universities to look to small companies to license technologies. You know, you're not limited to just large companies, and this really allows you, like we said, to give you a modest upfront fee, modest royalties up front, so that, you know, really give the small companies a chance to develop these technologies. And having that broader range of companies that you can sublicense to maximizes the probability that the technology will be developed, provide public benefit, and generate revenue for the university. Because after all, the universities and a lot of research institutes, the real goal is to get the technology out into the public to provide that public benefit. And so what is a sublicense? And the answer is really what it says in the contract. Sometimes the word sublicense is not defined, in which case we go back to industry standards. I think people have a general understanding of what a sublicense is, which is, you know, it's you license something, you give rights to a licensee, that licensee then takes that bundle of rights and distributes it down the line. But you really want to pay attention to how sublicense is defined in the contract. That's really is what a sublicense is in that particular transaction. And if it's not defined, will the original licensee claim compensation it receives is for something other than a sublicense? I mean, I think we all know the answer to that question. And if it is defined, what is the significance of that difference in that language? So I'm going to hand it over to Ashley to continue. Ashley, are you on mute?
I'm sorry, I was on mute, and I am having technical difficulties, and I have lost access to the slides. I apologize for this. I think I am back on. So the reason that sublicense income is such a difficult issue is that when we're negotiating the license agreement, then the sublicense that our licensee is going to do is way down the road. We're going to get them in the business, get them the technology, they're going to start developing it, and probably, particularly if in their things like the biopharmaceutical space, where the costs of late-stage clinical testing, the cost of building manufacturing facility, the need for global marketing and sales, is they're going to need to turn to a large corporation and do a deal that's likely going to include a sublicense, but they're going to do this well in the future. And as we're sitting there at the table negotiating with them, we're not going to know what the value of that technology is going to be at the time of the sublicense. We know it's low now, and so we're probably going to negotiate a fairly low upfront fee, low early maintenance fees and milestones, but looking to get more value as the technology grows in value. But we've got no idea how far down the pathway to the market the licensee is going to take them until they get to stage of the sublicense. We're not going to know how much our licensee will have invested in developing the technology by the time of the sublicense. It may be many millions of dollars by the time they get there. And we're not going to know the relative bargaining strength of the two parties at the table. We're not going to know whether our licensee is in a strong financial position or is in a weak one, and whether the sublicensee knows that they need to get a deal done and hence they can extract favorable terms for them. And then finally, we have no idea what the financial structure of the sublicense is going to be, what the payments are going to be, the lump sum payments, the milestone payments. Is the licensee going to get a royalty on sales from the sublicensee, or is there going to be a profit-sharing component? Is there going to be a manufacturing component? So there's all these uncertainties that we're going to have to deal with as we're sitting there negotiating with our licensee, trying to anticipate things way down the road. And our main objective in negotiating the sub-license income sharing provisions is going to be to ensure that the licensee can't structure the sub-license in a way to minimize what it pays the university. This may sound strange because as you're sitting there, particularly if you're negotiating with a startup, you are almost partners. You are giving them the technology that they're going to build this company around that hopefully will be successful and make a lot of money for them, and in the process make a lot of money for the university. You are on the same side of the table. Down the road, when that sublicense is done, certainly in the company, the people you negotiated with, the licensee, are going to be gone. University people tend to stick around more, so you may still be there. But the people looking at the licensee who are going to look to have to pay these checks to you are going to look upon the sublicense income sharing provisions as a tax on the hard work and the financial reward they've got from developing your embryonic technology and taking it to the stage where it can be sublicensed. And in that case that Emily mentioned at the beginning, we literally saw in some of the documents that people at the licensee referred to the payments to UCLA as a tax. That was very different from the attitude when the license was originally negotiated. So the first step is to clearly define the rights that are granted. You've got to make sure that the sublicense is defined as any rights granted to third parties under the license grant. And you've got to make sure you capture all types of agreements, things like options, if different IP rights are bundled together. You've got to make sure the profit-sharing agreements are covered. And that was the particular issue where Emily and I were on the opposite sides of this case in Medivation. So some of the questions the TLO needs to ask is the licensee intending to flip the license? You know, have they identified some quick opportunity to partner it that the university didn't? Is sublicensing going to be the only method of revenue generation? Or will the licensee take some part of the technology to market themselves? Will the licensee be bundling university intellectual property with its own intellectual property in agreements with third parties? And that often happens because we license the fundamental technology to the licensee and they build on it. They add extra patents, perhaps production patents, formulation patents, method of treating patents, things like this. And are there options to add additional university product-related IP? So what's the solution? The solution is to make sure that the university gets a piece of every payment that the licensee gets from its sublicensee. In the immortal words of Lou Burnerman, who ran tech transfer at Penn for many years and is now at Osage Partners, you will pay me every which way there is. It sounds greedy, it sounds overreaching, but it is basically the way to make sure that the licensee doesn't have an incentive to use words and structures in the sublicense agreement that are going to cost you money. Now, you certainly exclude items for which are deliverable and which you can document independently. Things like patent expense reimbursement, although you don't often see that as a component of sublicense agreements. Where you do see things is research support payments. If the sublicensee is going to pay the licensee to do part of the research for them, then it's not appropriate for the university to get a piece of that. And if the sublicensee purchases equity in the licensee, then There are limits on how much of that should be excluded from the university's share. So I think over the years, we've emerged to three models for structuring the sharing of sub-license income between the licensee and the university. The first model is what we call a pass-through, in which the running royalty obligation that the licensee has agreed to pay the university is passed through to the sub-licensee. So the result of this is that the university will get the same running royalty on the sub-licensee sales as if the licensee sold the product themselves. In addition, they get a set percentage of every payment received other than running royalties, which you sometimes see termed non-royalty income or even sub-license income. So that, I would say, is probably emerging as the stage of the art. After all, if the licensee has agreed that 4 or 5% is a reasonable royalty to reflect the value of the university's technology, why should there be a different number if a sub-licensee is selling the products? The second model is called an allocation, where the university gets a set percentage of every payment that the licensee gets from the sub-licensee, including running royalties. Why might you agree to this? Well, suppose you had agreed with the licensee that they would pay you a 6% royalty. They would be likely to argue, well, I can't agree to pay you 6% of the sub-licensee sales because I don't know what royalty I'm going to be able to get from them. What if I've taken 7 years, spent $50 million developing the technology, and I can only get a 12% royalty from them, and now I've got to share half of it, 6%, with you? Those are the sort of circumstances where they may say, well, let's just divvy up the payments, all the payments we get from them. And then the third model is a variant of the previous one. It's what we called a tiered allocation, where the university gets a lower percentage of payments received from the sub-licensee before commercialization, and perhaps a higher percentage of running royalties and any post-commercialization milestones afterwards. And this allows the licensee to use the money that they get from their sub-licensee, or to use more of it before commercialization to develop the technology. And that will hopefully allow them to raise less capital. And if the university is a shareholder in the licensee, then they have a vested interest in not seeing that stake diluted by additional fundraising more than they need to. And the tiers may be based on the timing of the sub-licensing post the license. And so you may see things like in year one, we'll give you 25% of any money we get. Year two, 20%. And year three and on, 15%. Be careful about having those step downs too great. I once had one that was so high that at about 9 months, the licensee came to me and said, look, we have somebody wants to do a deal. Can I do it at next year's rate? Otherwise, I'm just going to wait 3 months because I can keep the guy going for that long, and then I can pay you much less next year. So be careful you don't build that perverse incentive in there. And also, you may pick your tiers based on the stage of clinical development that a drug has got to, for instance. So let's look at a standard license income definition for the pass-through. Sublicense income means payments or other value that company receives from a sublicensee in consideration of a sublicense granted by company, including without limitation, license fees, equity, milestone payments, license maintenance fees, payments for distribution rights, and the fair market value of any non-cash consideration, but excluding the following payments. payments made in consideration for the issuance of equity or debt securities to the company at fair market value. And I'll come back and talk to that. Payments specifically committed to and incurred in the research and development of licensed products, including patent-related costs and expenses. And we talked about that earlier. And then excluding running royalties. And we're excluding them because we're going to get a pass-through and we're going to get paid on the sub-licensee sale. Now, I talked about in A here, payments made in consideration for the issuance of equity at fair market value. Why we put that in there is suppose a deal consists of $5 million in cash and $5 million in payment of equity. Then the and the sublicensee has agreed to that. The licensee might be motivated to say to the sublicensee, look, I'm going to have to give 25% of that $5 million cash to the university. I'm not going to have to give them 25% of the purchases of stock. So instead, why don't you pay me $10 million for the same number of shares, i.e. the same price, the same number of shares, but at double the price, and now I won't have to share any money with the university. So that's why we put fair market value in there. Often you include a premium over fair market value to reflect the fact that the licensee, the sub-licensee should be paying more than just an investor because they're getting a strategic value out of it. And then what is fair market value? If the company is publicly traded, it is typically the closing price on the 10 previous trading days before the announcement of the deal. And if the company is still privately traded or privately held, then fair market value is the price established in the most recent round of financing. Now, the incentive problem. Because the sublicensee income provision shifts value to the university from the original licensee, they're going to have an incentive to try and avoid sublicensee income provision. As I said, you'll see them referring it to it like a tax. And let's face it, none of us like to pay more taxes than we have to. And so they may try to treat payments that they're receiving from their sublicensee as falling outside the definition of sublicense income. So some of the incentives they have to avoid paying, to say the deal is not a sublicense, to say the payments aren't related to the sublicense for some other deal between the licensee and the sublicensee. An incentive to say the payments aren't within the definition of sublicense income, and the incentive to minimize the percentage. So some of the key issues, is there a sublicense? Are the payments related to the sublicense? Are the payments within the definition of sublicense income, minimizing the percentage, and the importance of information? And we'll look at these issues in the next slide. Now, is this where you take over, Jim?
Yeah, I think this is where I take over. So thanks,
okay,
Ashley. Thanks. I want to start by just kind of recapping some of the things that Emily and Ashley have said. So typical deals for universities are with small companies. And what that means is they typically want everything. They want an exclusive. They want it to all fields. And, of course, they don't have the means to actually execute on that. They also typically want low royalties and low financial terms because, one, they can't afford it, and two, they want some room on the other side to do deals with their partners, as Emily and Ashley have discussed. So when you do deals with those small companies, part of the business model is that they will seek partners. There's two ways of doing that. You can enter into a development deal with a bigger pharma partner, or you can hopefully, for some companies, they'd like to end up in an acquisition where they either merge with a company or get bought out completely. So what typically happens? So a common partnering deal for small companies is to find a large pharma partner who's interested in their technology. Maybe they've got a couple of targets, drug targets that they're interested in, or disease targets is probably a better way to say it. And usually the company does not take an immediate sub-license, right, because that implies responsibilities. That generally transfers the responsibility for developing the licensed product to the sub-licensee. So the more common way to do it is to enter into an option/development/sub-license agreement. So it starts out with an option, and it has some payment up front. It would typically have some milestone payments as the small company advances the particular product that the big pharma is interested in, typically maybe through phase two. And at that point, the large pharma then makes a decision about whether they want to take it forward or not. And in that case, they would execute or execute their option to take the sublicense. And they usually don't have to do anything except make a payment. So there's generally a sublicense fee that's due. So it's important here to realize, important to have a definition of what a sublicense agreement is, because we've had cases where licensees have come to us and said, oh no, that wasn't a sublicense agreement, that was an option agreement. Well, it was all one and the same agreement. So all of those terms, the option, the development, and the sublicense, are all baked into a single agreement. And so arguably, that is still a sublicense agreement. They may not have made their sublicense payment, but you still have a sublicense agreement. If your sublicense agreement definition does not capture all of that, you're going to find yourself in fights over the sublicensing income, as we'll talk about in a few minutes. So that's one thing to keep in mind. One of the alternatives to doing a partnering deal is to have a merger or have some other type of equity deal. This gets a little more difficult. We've tried to include some of those things in our sublicense income definitions and under our sublicense agreement definitions, and we in all cases get pushback. So one of the things that we've tried to do is just have language in our agreements, another financial term, which is an assignment fee, effectively. So I can give you a story about that. So about a decade ago, 2006, we had a license agreement with what was Cerner Therapeutics at the time. They were talking with Merck about a potential sub-licensing transaction. And the transaction got so expensive for Merck, they just decided it was simpler to buy them, which they did. So while we were sitting there thinking we were going to get a big sublicense income payment, we ended up with nothing as a result of that particular transaction. Now, it turns out it turns out we were dumb enough to hold on to the equity that we had in Cerner, so we made about $10 million. But not really because of anything that had to do with sublicensing income. So if we had not had the equity, if we had sold it much sooner or simply didn't take as much equity, we would have been left with nothing as a result of that particular transaction. So what we try to do is, it's hard to get it into sublicense income, in my opinion. At least we've never been able to do that. But we do have a separate provision where we say we either want a percentage of your change in control or acquisition price, or we want a fixed fee. And companies tend to go with the fixed fee a lot more often. So whether or not those kinds of deals should be captured by a sublicense income provision, I think is difficult to do. It's worth trying, because usually if you're going to get to a merger, at least that could probably merger/acquisition, that could probably be quite lucrative, even if you had a small percentage of that. I do think it will be difficult to get some of that through. So even generally, if you want to have a percentage, we find that we fight over that quite a bit, and usually companies are not willing to agree to that, because their concern is, or their belief, I should say, is that they think that they are adding such a huge amount of value relative to what we have provided for them that they don't want us to reap some reward at the end, and they find that a percentage is more objectionable than a fixed fee. So on the next slide, so is there a sublicense? So going back to my earlier point, so what if the licensee says a deal is not a sublicense? And so we have another bullet here that says, does the purpose of the deal matter? And the answer is yes. I mean, there are courts who have ruled that the purpose of the deal does matter as it relates to sublicense income, but the problem here is you're now in litigation, right? So litigation is going to cost you millions of dollars. In my experience, if you can get away with less than $5 million, you've done a good job. So you don't want to get into that situation where you now have to fight about whether it's a sublicense or not. So we had a different situation where we had our licensee had entered into that option slash development slash sublicense agreement. And because we did not have very good language in our license agreement, they argued that that option payment and even the development milestones were in fact not sublicense income. And so we ended up in mediation over that and ultimately resolved it. But by my way of thinking, if you go to mediation, you end up with half of what you're probably entitled to. It just seems to work out that way. So we subsequently changed our language to make it clear that a sublicense agreement means any agreement in which the company grants or offers to grant or promises to grant rights to the patent rights, et cetera. So, and that's language that we have different people have different language to say the same thing, but it's important that you define what that sublicense agreement is so that the licensee can't come to you and say, oh, sorry, that really wasn't a sublicense. So moving on to the next slide, you know, the importance of the language of the license agreement, as I just said, if you get to mediation, for example, or even if you get to court, human nature is to try and make both sides happy, so or to give something to both sides. So when you get in front of a judge or a jury, they're going to try and find a way, a neutral way, to try and resolve an issue. So it means the words do matter. So if you have, if you don't have words, they're going to try and resolve it in a way that may not be in your best interest. So you always want to have words that say exactly what you expect it to mean. So have a strong definition of sublicense agreement and have a strong definition of what sublicense income is. So we have on the next slide, on slide 20, we have so a couple of hypotheticals. So is there a sublicense? So hypothetical, what if you had a licensee that entered into a couple of different agreements? And Ashley had alluded to this earlier. So they're going to enter into three agreements. And one, they call it a sublicense. And they give $10 to the licensee. So this is obviously perverse, just to show, to make the example. And then they have a second agreement, which is services to develop the technology that was licensed through the sublicense agreement. And they're going to pay the licensee $10 million. And then a third one, they're going to rent a facility in which they're actually going to develop the technology, and that's a payment of $100 million. So not all three of those agreements are technically sublicense agreements if somebody were looking at any one of them individually, certainly not the rental agreement. But the courts would look at this and say, this is all part and parcel of your transaction, and you're really dodging the bullet here, and you're trying to lessen the value to the university, and you're just kind of shifting the money payments in places where they shouldn't be. So if you got to court, it's likely that, you know, reasonable people would look at this and say, well, that doesn't make sense that you'd pay $100 million to rent a facility and only pay $10 for the technology. But if you have the right language in your license agreement, which would say sublicense agreement means an agreement or a series of related agreements, then you would be making an attempt to capture all of these payments or all of these payments under different agreements to capture them as sublicense income. So while the first one is clearly a sublicense, the second one you could argue either way, and then the third one I don't think would on its face be looked at as a sublicense agreement, but arguably all three of those are part of a transaction and they've just been trying to shift the money to avoid paying the tax that Ashley has described. So it's important to make sure that you prevent this type of activity from happening. Similarly, when you look at agreements like I was referring to earlier, where you have an option fee and you have milestone payments, and you might have a development fee, and then you eventually have a sublicense fee, all of those are really just advance payments on the sublicense. So you want to make sure that those are captured because they will argue to you that, oh, no, that was not for the sublicense, that was for something else. So again, as we've been saying throughout the seminar, the words matter. Another thing that on slide 21, you know, another way to try and get out of having to pay is to do what we've been talking about, which is to call the agreement something else, right? So one of the things that you tend to do in your partnering deal, small company with a big company, is to call it a collaboration. And oftentimes that's what they call their agreements, right? This is a, you know, option collaboration agreement, whatever the case might be. And so, again, you have to have words in your agreement that makes clear that we don't care what you call this thing, that it's actually going to be deemed a sublicense agreement. And so we use words in our agreements currently that says, for the avoidance of doubt, any agreement that confers or promises to confer rights under this agreement, meaning our license agreement, regardless of its name or title, shall be deemed a sublicense agreement. So you want to do everything you can to try and make clear that we're not letting you hide behind some other agreement that might have a title that doesn't pertain to sublicensing. On the next one, issue two, are payments related to a sublicense. So again, this comes down to what your words say. So as they're asking this, so what will a licensee say it means? They're obviously going to say it doesn't mean it's a sublicense term or it's sublicense income. We're obviously going to take the opposite position. So you need to have contractual obligations laid out clearly, or you're simply not going to get paid. Or if you're going to have to fight to get paid, and in many cases, it may not be worth the effort. So my own view is, I think it's a little bit cynical, but I think companies generally take the position that most universities will not sue over these types of things. It costs a lot of money. You have to have a lot of confidence that you're going to prevail in such a litigation. Otherwise, it's really, you're going to waste millions of dollars. So I think companies, at least in my experience, companies have made their decisions not to pay us on that kind of assumption that we're not going to fight over it. If you go on to slide number 23, says, are payments related to a sublicense? So what's the difference between these two terms? So, quote, sublicense means any transaction in which the licensee grants a third party a license to make, have, made, use, sell, offer for sale, or import any licensed products, versus the one beneath it, which says sublicense defined to be, quote, a portion of a transaction that grants to a third party a license. And so that's really tricky language, right? So you have to decide if you want the licensee to have the ability to determine what the relative value of your IP is relative to anything else, right? So if you look at the language in the bottom sentence, that's giving the licensee the opportunity to say, of that $100 million deal that I did, your piece was only worth $1 million. And you get to collect your percentage on that million. So we refer to it, as Ashley was saying earlier, that's allocation, right? So they can get to say, I'm allocating the value of your IP or your license rights relative to other things that I've included in this transaction. So in the above language, any transaction in which you grant a third party a license, that means you're entitled to the benefits of the entire transaction. So let's say that they throw in your intellectual property and they throw in some of theirs and the company's IP and maybe something else that they've had to license in from a third party. That entire transaction then becomes the basis for the calculation of your percentage, whatever your sublicensing income percentage might be. And so obviously that makes a big difference. So as Ashley or Emily said earlier, at the early stage, you can't ascertain what the relative value is going to be of your technology. But to the extent that it forms the basis of a company and everything else that they do, I would argue it should be due a significant portion of whatever they do going forward. And so you want to say to them, sorry, if you do a transaction, I don't care what's in that transaction, if it includes rights to our intellectual property, we're entitled to our piece, our percentage of that transaction based on our contract. So obviously the top sentence is far better than the lower sentence in terms of what you're going to get in terms of proceeds. So on the next slide, on slide 24, it says, are payments related to a sublicense? And so again, the words are going to matter. So in this case, if you look at the first bullet, it says sublicense revenue means all consideration received by licensee in return for the grant of rights. So to me, that limits the what the licensee can then say was the consideration they received, because depending upon what the bigger transaction was, the sublicense revenue is now limited to that grant of rights, which they get to define in some instance, right? So second bullets, and then the licensee goes on and they enter into a master research and collaboration agreement with some sublicensee, which has other technology included with it, right? So it's a bigger deal than just the intellectual property from your university. So the licensee is saying, well, you know, your contribution was only 9.4% of that option fee at that time, and they don't have to share other parts of the particular deal that they had concluded. And so the language up above, I think, makes it difficult for City of Hope to make that argument. Now, how that shakes out in court, I didn't follow that case. But the point is, the language has left it open to interpretation by the licensee. And as Ashley said, since this is a tax, you know that they're not going to interpret it in your favor. And so you're going to lose out on that one. And so a court may decide whether City of Hope was entitled to the 15% or entitled to a portion of the rest of the deal. But if you had the correct language in your agreement, there wouldn't be any debate about it. Now, that's not to say that a licensee still won't try to game the system and force you to go to litigation to get your money, but you're going to be in a much better place if the contract says what it says and it says what you need it to say. So going on to slide 25, are payments within the definition of sublicense income? So there's different ways, as Ashley said earlier, of defining of the language they use to define what sublicense income is. Our preference is to say it includes everything under the sun, and then to make those few exceptions. And Ashley's already mentioned those. You know, typically we're going to exclude if you have specific dollars committed towards research and development, those tend to get excluded. We always exclude royalties because we want that to be a pass-through. And there may be other things that you can exclude as well. The typical one, you know, equity paid at the fair market value, things like that. I think that's a lot better than leaving it ambiguous as to what is included. So if you were to actually use language that kind of limits it and says, oh, sublicense income is limited to upfront payments and milestones, then as Ashley said earlier, you now have the incentive problem where it's in the licensee's incentive to call these things something else. So no, that's not an upfront payment, or those are not milestone payments. I'm calling them something else. And so it just becomes a way to shift the income to the licensee into a different bucket so he doesn't have to pay you. So you want to make your definition as broad as possible, and then your negotiation with your licensee is going to be around those specific things that would be excluded. The other thing I would mention about some of those exclusions, though, you do have to be careful about the reimbursement of research and development. So depending upon how that's written is another trap for the university. So you want it to be clear. Our preference is to have the company perform the research, document their expenses, and then get reimbursed by the sublicensee, as opposed to them just saying in their agreement, oh, this is prepaid R&D. That's a way to try and prevent the licensee from having to pay you. Slide 25. Did I just miss a slide? Are we? We're on slide 26. So here's an example of a broad definition. So sublicense income means all remuneration received by licensee under or on account of any sublicense. I would actually change that last word. I think it's far better to say on account of any sublicense agreement, because we've had people, licensees, try and argue to us that, oh no, only this little piece pertains to the quote-unquote sublicense part of the transaction. And I think by making it broader to include all remuneration received under a sublicense agreement, means that you're going to be, the payment calculation is going to be based on a much bigger number. At one time we had a colleague from UC working with us on this presentation, and she provided this language that they have in their licensing guidelines, which says the university should receive a fair share of all consideration, including royalty and non-royalty income received by licensee from the sub-licensee. In fact, in some of UC's licenses, they actually, in their sub-license income provision, they actually try to get a percentage of the difference between what the sub-licensee is paying in royalties to the licensee and the royalty payment that the licensee is making to the university. So, for example, if we're getting a 6% royalty and the licensee negotiates a 12% royalty, we would then get a percentage of the difference, which would be a percentage of 6%. That's a tough thing to get, but there are people who use that in some of their negotiations. Slide 27, are payments within the definition of sublicense income. So the key issue is, what do the exclusions cover? My preference is to keep the exclusions to a minimum or not have any. It's very difficult to get that. But we do have, you know, people want to exclude patent cost reimbursement, things like that. We generally say no. If you get a dollar, we get a percentage of it. The exceptions, as I said, would be royalties, running royalties, and the purchase of equity at fair market value. And we try and put in language about what fair market value means as well. So sometimes we, if you're a publicly traded company, you know what that is, because you can pick a date, so the day before we close our transaction, that's what fair market value is. If you're a private company, we try to use the value that's been asked, that's been set by the board previous to that particular transaction. So we don't, if there's a premium to be paid, we expect to get our percentage on that premium paid for equity purchased. Common payments excluded are royalties on sales and reimbursement for research costs. We hate to include reimbursement for research costs, but we generally do. As I said, you need to word that carefully so that they can't simply say in their agreement that, oh, this is a payment for research and development. You want it to be tied for actual costs incurred by the company. So you want to make sure that it's a reimbursement and not just a big fat payment that they're going to call R&D costs. Should royalties be excluded? What is a royalty on sales? So I think I'm going to let Ashley take over on this, because he's had some experience in the Medivation case about some of the language on this.
Thank you, Jim. So yeah, this Medivation versus the Regents of the University of California, like Gaul, this litigation was divided into three parts. And the first one, which I was not involved with, the definition of the contract was, sublicensing income means income received by licensee under or on account of sublicenses. Sublicensing income includes income received, including but not limited to license issue fees, milestone payments, and the like, but specifically excludes royalties on the sale or distribution of licensed products or the practice of licensed methods. The problematic language here is milestone payments and the like. That really is not very specific. And the issue in this case was that there were sales milestones. UC was supposed to get payments when sales of licensed products hit certain targets, and Medivation made the argument that since sales milestones are paid on sales, they're a royalty and hence should be excluded. The judge didn't buy that. The judge said it is commonly understood in the industry that milestone payments connote event-driven or success payments, which are distinct from royalty payments. Two, it's also commonly understood the milestone payments include payments made upon the occurrence of both regulatory milestones and sales milestones. And three, the parties understood that these terms had these commonly understood meetings when they negotiated the exclusive license agreement. So UC won that one. UCLA, Medivation lost it. I think the total sales milestones were in the $300 million range, and it was worth $30 million. And the court went on and said at all relevant times, Medivation and the Regents understood that the term royalties was used to mean monetary payments based on a percentage applied to each individual sale. And they also understood that the ELA imposed separate obligations in Medivation to pay the Regents 4% of royalties and an additional 10% of sublicensing income, and that these two types of payments represented separate streams of income to the Regents. So as I said, UC1, UCLA, Medivation lost. How could we have fixed that? Well, look at this suggested language. Let's be much more specific about what we mean by milestone payments. So, including but not limited to license fees, issue fees, milestone payments, including but not limited to payments conditional on the achievement of patent, preclinical, clinical, regulatory, sales, or any other milestone. If that language had been in there, then a whole lawsuit would have gone away. I think at this point we're going over to... Oh, no, I keep going. I'm sorry. The second argument was our profit-sharing payments within the definition of sublicensing income. And in this first lawsuit over the sales milestones, the court said that the definition of sublicensing income was ambiguous. The question of whether a royalty on the sale included or excluded profit sharing was to go to a jury to decide what the drafters meant, and the matter was settled after jury selection, so we never did get a judicial determination. So the issue here was that the deal between Medivation and Astellas, the company with which they partnered, included a 50-50 profit sharing, profit and loss sharing in the U.S., and then tiered royalties on sales outside the U.S. And UCLA asserted that the profit-sharing payments weren't a royalty on sale, and so they should get their pass-through 4% royalty, but they should also get 10% of the profit-sharing payments, since they were just another sub-license income sharing. That would, the way the numbers worked out, would have roughly doubled the effective royalty rate that UC would have received. So how would a jury decide such an issue? Well, they'd have been presented to show what the parties intended at the time of contracting, what are the words they used in the contract, what did they say to each other about profit sharing and royalties, how did the parties treat the money, and what is the industry standard as presented by experts on the meaning of royalties, royalties on the sale, profit sharing, and sublicensing income. But I think a jury would probably have looked at the overall issue of fairness on this. And if there is a profit sharing and a co-promotion deal, is that some reason that the royalty rate to UC should suddenly double compared with if Medivation sold the product alone or whether Astellas sold the product alone? But as I said, we did not get a judicial determination. How could we have fixed this and made another lawsuit go away? Well, instead of excluding just royalty payments, but specifically excludes running royalty payments on the sale or distribution of licensed products or the practice of licensed methods, irrespective of whether based on sales revenue, unit sales, or some measure of profits. That would have fixed it. So you can see, you know, and The thing that was amazing to me in this case was that the University of California system is the biggest and one of the oldest and certainly the most sophisticated licensing organizations in the U.S. And they've been using these words for a long time. And suddenly you have not one, but two lawsuits over what constituted about a line and a half of text in this agreement. So some of the other potential problem areas, research support. Well, research support can be done different ways. They can say, yes, we'll pay you so much per FTE, and we want you to put 10 FTEs on this. Equally, they may do it in a milestone-driven way, that when you get to this point, we'll pay you this much. When you get to the next point, we'll pay you that much. And I don't think that those payments should get sucked into milestone payments. So potential language, excluding payments received for research carried out by licensee at request of sublicensee, whether made to reimburse specific scientific effort on an FTE plus expenses basis or an achievement of scientific milestone. Minimizing percentage? Is this you, Emily? You're right, it's you. I'm sorry.
No worries. So I want to go back and address one thing that Ashley said about the language that was litigated in the Medivation case. And, you know, as we stated, we were on opposite sides. And one of the things I want to note is that one of the issues there was, again, the words really matter, right? So royalty payments on the sale. And one of the things I want to clarify is the position was, you saw a prior opinion that said royalties meant a percentage on each and every sale. So when you have a word royalty on the sale, the argument was that the royalty is a percentage of each and every sale, and profit payments are not a percentage on each and every sale because you can have a sale and have no profit. And that is where sort of that's where the language of the contract really became the crux of the argument there. I just wanted to point out that why the on the sale part was so important in that particular case. But moving on to
I am not going to investigate this issue with you over a webinar, Emily.
No, I appreciate that, but I just, you know, because we're talking about why words matter, and when you're in court,
yep.
that, you know, as a litigator, I focus on those words, and that's where, you know, you focus on the words of the contract.
Yep.
And so moving on to minimizing percentage, some agreements, as we've talked about, have multiple tiers. And so, for example, the sublicensing percentage changes as the original licensee moves, in this case, a pharmaceutical compound toward approval. So if the first a percentage might go down if the first person is tested in a phase 3 clinical trial, for example. And, you know, it reflects the amount of work that has gone into developing that compound. That's generally the philosophy behind it. But the agreement might also set up various classes of sublicense income with various percentages as well. Now, the issue here, though, is, of course, the incentive problem. And the real thing that we need to focus on is how do you, as the licensor, get the information you need to determine when that percentage moves? Do you have that information? Can you verify it? And also, is the condition action, meaning like whatever triggers the lowering of the percentage, subject to manipulation by the licensee or subject to an action of a third party? And if it's, for example, you can see, I think Jim maybe mentioned this earlier, where it was like, look, you know, if you don't lower the percentage, we're just going to keep the negotiations going until I hit that benchmark. Or maybe you have, you know, you just need to, the licensee just needs to line up one person for that clinical trial and get that one person, you know, treated, and then boom, the percentage goes down and they time it so that it's right before they enter into a big deal. And, you know, that happens. And you just have to be aware that it happens. And the real thing is, how do you get the information so that you know when it happens, so that you know when something is moving to a different bracket. And I think the importance of information, I'm going to give this back to Jim. And I know, Jim, you've talked a lot about various ways you're able to try to control or get information or various ways you build that into your contracts. It'd be great to hear about that.
All right. Thanks, Emily. So I think most universities probably have language in their contracts that say you have to send reports. I mean, if you look at diligence sections, it usually says the company has to report on an annual basis what it is that they're doing to develop the intellectual property, to develop the patent rights. Your contract should also make that a burden on the sublicensee. So even though the licensee will be responsible for reporting it, it still should be an obligation that flows to whoever is actually developing the intellectual property. So you want to make – the problem is, though, a lot of universities, ourselves included, oftentimes we don't ask for that report when it's not forthcoming. So as part of your own diligence, you need to be scrutinizing your existing license agreements to see who is actually living up to the terms of the contract and giving you that reporting information about them performing their diligent development activities and reporting on clinical development milestones, etc. I think, though, as it relates to sublicense income, the biggest problem that we've run into actually is getting information that a sublicense agreement has actually been executed. So there's a couple things that get involved with this. So we had one case where the licensee entered into one of these option development sublicense agreements and didn't tell us because their attitude was, well, it's not a sublicense agreement, even though it was. And so it was years later when they sent us a very low sublicense income payment that we found out that they'd actually entered into this agreement. So again, this is just them not following the rules of the contract, and it's our fault as well for not making them follow them. So I think you have to be diligent in terms of policing your licensees and making sure that your agreement has the right terms in it, but then making sure that your licensee follows up and lives up to the conditions of the contract. The biggest item we fight now when it comes to sublicense income agreements is the licensee wanting to be able to send us redacted copies of the sublicense agreement. And to me, that's like asking for trouble, right? So it's basically them saying, well, just trust us. We'll tell you how much we owe you. And so we have taken the position over the last number of years that that's actually a deal killer. Our view is that our license agreement has confidential information protection so that the things that you provide us are confidential, and that applies to your sublicensee as well. And so therefore, if you want to do a license with us, you have to give us a fully executed, unredacted copy of that sublicense agreement. Now, what some of them will argue is that, well, but what if it's got a lot of research and development plans, et cetera, et cetera? There are ways to deal with that. One that we've instituted recently is to say, fine, you still have to send us the unredacted copy. We will have 10 business days to basically summarize the financial payment terms of that agreement, and then we'll allow you to redact it in any way that you want and send it back to us for our records so that we can make sure that we're actually getting all of the information that we need. I've never seen – they like to argue that that's going to kill their potential for partnering. I've never seen that happen, and we've done lots of licenses where there are sublicensees. So you should insist on getting a fully executed, unredacted copy. Otherwise, you're not going to know what it is that you're dealing with. And not to be to think of nefarious intent, but you'll run across people who will try and cheat you out of what you do simply because they have the ability to do so. So if they can hide some financial transaction from you or financial term, there are some people who just might well do that. So best to protect yourselves. And then finally, one of the most important provisions. We tend to have it for our licensees, which is audit rights. Not always do people think that that has to apply to a sublicensee. So because you're going to collect royalties at a minimum from the licensee as well as the sub-licensee on the sales that they're going to provide, you want to make sure that you have the right to audit the sub-licensee, not just for net sales, but for performance under their agreement. So you want to be able to track down what it is the sub-licensee has paid to the licensee, not just for sales of product, but also for the terms of their contracts. So I think that's it.
One more slide. So if you are interested in following up more on this, this article was the lead article in the March 2018 edition of Les Nouvelles, the Journal of the Licensing Executive Society. You'll see the language that is in these slides in that document and additional thoughts. I'm going to have to duck out at this point. So I was looking at a couple of the questions, one which I think pertain to my section. One was, would it make sense to define fair market value in the agreement? Absolutely yes. And the second question was, can you repeat that language that you use? And it was something like, licensee shall pay the sub-license income sharing percentage of the excess of payments for purchase of equity in sub-licensee over fair market value, where fair market value is defined, if the company is public, as the closing price of the stock on the 10 trading days before the announcement of the deal, or if the company is privately traded, either my formulation, the price paid in the last financing, or Jim's formulation, the most recent fair market value price established by the board of directors of the company. So I'm going to duck out at that point. I apologize for that. And I will leave you in the good hands of Jim and Emily.
Thanks, Ashley.
Thank you. Oh, great. So I guess, should we go through these questions? I'm seeing questions coming up. That was a question for Jane. Sorry, I'm getting
so. Yeah, it's question seven. So, to the person who sent in question seven about critiquing their language, first of all, I'm not an attorney. Number one, we've just been around this business for a long time. So rather than try and critique it here, I'd be happy to send you a follow-up email and give you my thoughts on that.
And then in response to bulletproof language for sublicense, royalty, sublicense, and revenue and exclusions, I don't think there is such a thing as bulletproof language. We just do the best we can. Licensees and sublicensees will always find a way to try to avoid to pay as little as possible. I think that's just the nature of the beast. So we just try to do the best we can to clarify the language. And unfortunately, bulletproof is probably a little out of reach.
Yeah, and I'd be happy to send an example of our language. I'm not saying it's the best. I mean, I think every time we get cheated or abused by a licensee, then you learn from that experience and you can tighten up your language every time that happens. So unfortunately, since we've been abused on more than one occasion, I think we have some better language, but that doesn't mean it's the best, certainly.
Yeah. Broader is better unless you are intending to be as narrow as you can be. Can you talk about best practices for sharing in recoveries when the licensee is granted rights to enforce the licensed patent? A lot of times that's addressed in the license agreement. Do you want to handle that, Tim?
Yeah, so I don't know if you're if that means you're asking a question whether somebody has the right to go after infringers, but our license typically details that. So if you're an exclusive licensee, you get the first crack at going at pursuing infringers. And then we have language that describes how people get paid if there is a recovery. And so usually everybody gets their money back, meaning, you know, the person, the licensee, if they took on the lawsuit, they get their legal expenses back. And then we get back the royalty that we should have received on those sales that were infringing. And then anything left over or anything that's considered to be, you know, punitive damages, those types of things, then we split that 50-50. That I'm not saying that's a best practice. That's what we use. It seems to be generally accepted by our licensees.
Okay, and Emily, I think that that on line 10, I think that person wanted to hear Jim's take on the question that Ashley graciously answered. The one, can you repeat the language you use? The words matter, of course.
Here's, and I can send this by email, so I think it must have been our definition of sublicense income, if I recall. So, sorry, sublicense agreement. So we have a definition in our license agreement that says a sublicense agreement means any agreement in which company grants, offers to grant, or promises to grant rights to the patent rights, the biological materials, know-how, or licensed product pursuant to section such and such in our agreement. It says, including by way of example, but not limitation, sublicenses, options, rights of first refusal, rights of first negotiation, payments for distribution rights, etc. And then it says, for the avoidance of doubt, any agreement that confers or promises to confer rights under this agreement, regardless of its name or title, shall be deemed to be a sublicense agreement. We, for our sublicense income definition, we do have three exclusions. So our sublicense income definition says, sublicense income means any payments or other value that company receives from a sublicensee in consideration of the sublicense agreement, including without limitation, upfront fees, option fees, license fees, equity, milestones, and license maintenance fees, etc., but excluding the following payments: A, payments made in consideration for the issuance of equity or debt securities of a company at fair market value, B, payments specifically committed to the further development of licensed products, and we've changed that to talk about reimbursement, and then C, royalties. We didn't talk about it during the seminar, but we've had some debate about distribution agreements, and so we added this additional language which says, in addition, to the extent company receives payments from any third party for distribution rights, such payments shall be sublicense income to the extent they are not payments for the sale of licensed product to such third-party distributor. To the extent the payments are for the sale of licensed product to such third-party distributor, the payments shall be net sales. So that's come up in the context of you might have some great drug and somebody wants to be the distributor for it. One of the things they can do is give you a big upfront payment. Right, so they say, fine, I'm going to give you $100 million, but I get to be your distributor, exclusive distributor in these territories. And so we would argue that that big upfront payment is actually sublicensing income, and I think our agreement covers that. But at the same time, our licensee did not want to have us confuse the fact that they're going to be selling their product to that third-party distributor, right? That's going to be the basis of their royalties. And so we made clear that if what they're paying you for is payment for the licensed product, then that's not a sublicense income payment. So, and again, I can, if somebody wants examples of our language, I'm happy to provide it. I see there's another question that says, do you ever grant sublicensees right to enforce? So we do not. We only grant the licensee the right to enforce the patent rights, and there's a reason for that. So typically when you do a license with a small company or anybody in the pharma space, they want exclusive rights for all fields. And so if the licensee wants that and we give it to them, then we expect them to be responsible for going after infringers. When they do their partnering deals, at least in my experience, a partnering deal tends to be for one licensed product or, you know, a few disease targets, so that the sublicensee is not getting broad enough rights. And I suspect, Emily knows better than I suspect they would not have standing to sue in that circumstance. So we expect it to be taken care of by the licensee.
And a lot of times you don't know who your sublicensees are going to be. You don't have control over that. And so I haven't seen it happen. And I think it would probably not be as advised because you're just not as familiar with them as well. And I do agree that there are standing issues. Following up, the sublicensee.
So I don't know of any sublicensee who gets the right to enforce our patent rights. So I don't think that would apply.